Views and opinions expressed by callers, guests, and hosts do not necessarily reflect those of the Black Talk Radio Network and Black Talk Media Project. Black Talk Radio is new black media for the new millennium. Tuned in to Black Talk Radio News. Today's date is January the 21st on this 2017. The year they say is 2017. It is a Saturday evening as we broadcast to you from Black Talk Radio Network, the world's number one digital radio and podcasting platform. I should qualify that by saying the world's number one black digital radio and podcasting platform. You can find us again at blacktalkradionetwork.com. So lots of things that we could talk about. There's never a shortage of topics or issues that arise during the week. I have picked out a few stories to take a look at, to delve into, but the lines are open for whatever news that any of our listeners would like to share. Any questions or comments, let me get those out the way for those who may not have the numbers so that y'all can have those numbers in case you would like to participate. The telephone number is 866-510-9025. That's 866-510-9025. Another number is 704-802-5056. That's 704-802-5056. Once you are in, if you want to comment, you can just listen if you choose. You can just hit ** to put yourself in the comment queue. I'll see you or hear you and come to you. All right, so let's get into some of these news stories. Well, before I do that, I like to give a little bit of network news. Nothing really happening that's urgent that I need to report, meaning there's nothing negative happening to the network that I need to report. Everything seems to be going okay with not only blacktalkradionetwork.com, but our new social media community that we launched last year in August, which is btrcommunity.com, which is a subscription-based social media service. Everything has been going okay. I don't have any complaints about that. Now, in relation to our mission as a nonprofit, that is the Black Talk Media Project, which manages Black Talk Radio Network and BTR Community, we have a mission. And what is our mission? To elevate black voices, not just any black voices, but independent, unencumbered black voices. So this network was actually born because we felt like we needed a safe space to where we could produce the type of content that we wanted to produce for people who look like us and who share in the same issues that we share in, or to share in the same oppression or whatnot. Now, in the interest of spreading and elevating these voices through the various programs that you hear on our station, as well as the other independent stations that's on our platform, but in terms of those who broadcast on this station, Black Talk Radio, we also, of course, produce podcasts after those programs. And so now we have added Blog Talk Radio. Yes, you heard that correctly. Blog Talk Radio as one of the platforms where we are distributing podcasts from Black Talk Radio Network. Now, for those who have been with us since the beginning, y'all know that we at one time were suspended before being reinstated on Blog Talk Radio. We had not been on that platform or produced a program on that platform since, I would say, maybe 2012. We might have uploaded a couple of podcasts, but we really stopped broadcasting on there in 2008. We still are not broadcasting on their platform, but we are using it to distribute our podcast from our main feed. So we have, in fact, returned to where we started, because Black Talk Radio started as a channel, a podcasting channel on their platform that was made up of various hosts. And so that is where it was born. So we returned there just about 24 hours ago to continue to elevate Black voices and distribute our content. And I've been quite pleased with the downloads of the podcast that we sent over there, the downloads on that network. In 24 hours, over 1,000 downloads already. So that looks like it's a good move. If we feel like it's not worth it, that it's not increasing the number of downloads, which in 2016, we had our biggest year in terms of our broadcast reach, in terms of the digital radio station, and in terms of distributing podcasts. So we want to continue to build on what we're doing. So that is why we have returned Black Talk Radio's programming to that platform. You know, at one time we were just trying to be a standalone platform, and we was hoping that a lot of Black hosts would follow us and follow our lead and work with us, but most of them did not. So, you know, it's not that we're giving in to anything. No, we are about our mission. What is our mission? To spread and elevate the independent voices in the Black community. So if you are on that platform, you will start seeing podcasts being posted as they are imported from our network, blacktalkradionetwork.com. So welcome to those, because when we left there, we had almost 1,000 subscribers, and of course those subscribers still remain there. So I'm not too surprised that we had that many downloads of that content. All right, that's about it that I have for network news. We did have another class this morning, or I should say this afternoon. We have the new media question and answer webinar on Saturdays from 1 to 3 p.m. Eastern. And what that is to help people who want to learn how to harness new media technology so that we can control the images, can control the messages that come out of our mouths, and not have puppet masters, you know, with an arm up our rectums and, you know, working our mouths and what have you. So yeah. All right, some of the stories that I want to get into. The former CEO of USA Inc., of course that would be Barack Obama, has been replaced, and he left office without addressing many issues important to the Black community. He did not release a single political prisoner associated with the Black Power movement, even though it is widely known, it is widely accepted that the U.S. government framed many of the Black leaders during the 60s, 70s, and 80s of those it did not outright kill in its COINTELPRO operations. You know, they framed them. They put them in prison, and many of them remain in prison today. Obama was likely their last chance at ever being released, but now we know they never really had a chance even with him. He also did not remove cannabis from the DEA scheduled list of dangerous drugs, even though you've had more than half the states. I would say a third, no, a half is larger than a third. I would say almost two-thirds of states in the United States of America have legalized cannabis in some form or fashion. I think the science, I know the science has shown that it is not dangerous. It is not dangerous on the level of heroin. It is not dangerous on the level of crack cocaine or powder cocaine. It's just simply not dangerous. It's a natural plant that has certain properties that have found to be able to treat a number of health issues. But like anything can be abused. You can abuse food. You can become addicted to food, abuse it, and then you're like 400 pounds needing triple bypass surgery. So anything can be abused. So, but anyway, with the majority of people who have found themselves in prison are either associated with nonviolent drug use or nonviolent drug sales. That makes up the bulk of the prisoners in the United States, the modern day slaves. And so it would have been a big deal. It would have really been a big deal for him to remove that and get the federal government out of the business of regulating cannabis and let the states continue to tax and regulate that plant like they do so many other things. So that's something I want to take a look at, because it's unlikely that the Trump administration is going to remove it. So that's a tool that's going to remain in place for them to put people into slavery over. So that's something I want to look at more. Donald Trump, as you may know, as I think the world knows, has been sworn in as the new CEO of USA Inc. Mr. Eddie Glaude Jr., I think he is a professor or the chair of African American Studies. I forget the name of the university. We'll pull that up. But he published a piece in Ebony.com that says there are three areas black communities must organize around for the long-term future. And he's talking about with a different president, there must be different tactics. I'm not so sure about that, but the three issues, the main areas that he said we need to focus on is organizing around education, jobs, and criminal justice. It's not a terribly long piece. We'll share some of that. Also, another story to take a look at. You got a story coming out of Press TV. They published an article. I think it was an interview with Ron Paul, or it was based on something Ron Paul said. But the question is, what will foreign policy look like under the Trump administration? Will the United States military find itself in yet another military conflict, or will the current conflicts like in Syria, like in they're not really in Libya, but I think they may be pulled into Libya. But anywhere that they, Afghanistan, still in Iraq. So will those escalate? Will those escalate? And then, like on Tando Radio Show, Dave has talked about in a couple of shows with these confrontations with China, Russia, and Iran. Are we headed for a global war? Then I have a question. Can white America survive much longer with these nonstop wars? Again, the statistical data from the Center for Disease Control is showing that white people here in the United States, birth rate is below their death rates. And I know all of these wars, I mean, just there hasn't been a war or a military conflict that soldiers have not been involved in since World War II. And I'm speaking of the United States. And I'm sure that's had an impact on their declining population numbers. And so I'm asking the question, can they survive another administration, you know, another 4 years, another 8 years, another 12 years with these nonstop wars? Will this lead to the extinction of white males? Well, of course, you know, as Dave has pointed out on his show, Tando Radio Show, now they have put it in place that they can start drafting your daughters. Now women have to register for the Selective Service Draft. Even though they don't have an active draft, hey, if they don't have enough boots on the ground, then guess what? They will bring back that draft. And I'm just trying to see what the future is going to look like for white people, especially white males. because they, I think, are the white males, I should say, here in the United States, could become extinct in the next 50 years or so due to their own behavior, due to their own propensity for violence and what have you, because of white supremacy. So yeah, that's something to take a look at. But former congressman and former presidential candidate Ron Paul says there is a neoconservative axis in the Senate made up of John McCain, Lindsey Graham, and Tom Cotton. I think they're all Republicans. I know McCain and Graham are Republicans, but Ron Paul say they might destroy America by increasing the military spending up to $5 trillion over the next 5 years. And so you might say, well, what did that got to do with the black community? Well, that's your $5 trillion too, you know what I'm saying? Because you do pay taxes, you do pay taxes. That's your reparations money, that's your free college tuition money. Yeah, that's your paid maternity leave money. That's your what do they call that? Your pre-K, early childhood education money. That's your hood money, affordable housing money. Yeah, it affects us. Okay, so that's the story I want to take a look at. And here's another story. An article on Bloomberg, which is a mainstream financial outlet, says that we cannot keep turning prisoners into slaves because it does not deter crime. Now, I really haven't looked at the article, but the news is the fact that you got a major publication. Again, this is a mainstream financial outlet, and they used the headline that said prisoners, we can't keep turning prisoners into slaves. And I was like, wow, I was really taken aback by that, because it just, you know, a lot of people are under the wrong conception that the United States abolished slavery when it did not, which we have a program on this network called New Abolitionist Radio that has been coming on weekly at 8 o'clock p.m. Eastern time every Wednesday night, for the past 5 years, where that is all we have been trying to tell people, is that the 13th Amendment does not abolish slavery. It makes an exception for it. They can make you a slave if they convict you of a crime. And then we give the racist history of the criminal justice system, the black codes, and the convict leasing, and how all of that is just a refinement of slavery. It doesn't represent the abolishment of slavery. It represents the refinement of slavery. And so I definitely want to take a look at that article, but I'm telling you, the news to me is the fact that they use the word slave in relation to prisoners here in this country. That's big news. So we continue. We in the new abolitionist community continue to shape the narrative. This ain't mass incarceration. This is a continuation of slavery. And it's just great. It's just great to see that fact being reflected in mainstream outlets. The last story that I will share, this one is really, really interesting. Because we actually had a conversation about this, not directly about this, but we had a conversation about this last week in terms of interracial dating. So we got this story where you have this white teenager who, she's in high school, about to go to college. She has a black boyfriend, and she putting her parents on blast, saying that her parents are racist for being against her relationship with this black male. She says her parents took everything from her, like her, I think it was her car, you know, did everything except for kick her out on the street. But then also said they not paying for her to go to college as long as she in this relationship. So she's raising money. She's raised over $30,000 on a GoFundMe account telling this story. Now, the father says he is not racist and does not want his daughter dating a black male because of racial hostilities in the South. And I'm like, that's quite interesting that he would say that, because I know a lot of black parents who are saying the same thing to their children. So, again, I am not one of those who think all white people are racist. I agree with Neely Fuller. I believe they're in a system of racism, this global system of racism. There are three classifications of people. There are white people, there are non-white people, and there are what he calls white supremacists, racists. So, with that out the way, with that qualifier, I'm not willing to call this white man a racist for not wanting his daughter to date a black male, if he is being sincere about his reason. And his reasoning is racial hostilities in the South. And I was, you know, immediately reminded by a video that went viral on social media, where you had a black male and a white female who appeared to be in a relationship. Well, they were in a relationship, but they were in this restaurant. I think this was in Atlanta, I'm not sure, but it was a restaurant. It might have been a black restaurant. Everybody in there was black, except for this white girl who is sitting at a table with a black male sharing a plate of food. And so this other black male goes up to him and confronts the other black male and talking to him about, you know what, you mean to tell me you couldn't find a black woman to date? You dating this white woman and all that? So again, that would be an example of what some of us tell our children about why we don't want them in interracial relationships, because you will face hostility out there in the world. So there's a number of reasons. So if that's his reason, if that's really sincerely his reason, is because of racial hostility shown towards interracial couples, that I would say that does not necessarily make him a racist. All right? Because I think I've said last week, I've said something similar to my daughters, considering where we live, that I know don't bring no white boys home because of your dad ain't feeling that. All right. And so, you know, how can I turn around and call this man a racist? And I said the same thing to my daughters. Okay. Now, I would not disown my daughters if they did. And there are people in my family that have produced children with white people, and I don't mistreat them. I still see them as part of the family. The only thing I care about is whether or not, you know, they are being mistreated in that relationship, because if they get mistreated, then there's going to be a problem. Okay. But again, this also ties into what we was discussing last week about the fear that white people have of genetic annihilation, and whether or not black males should be in interracial relationships with black males. So that's the story. All of this is up for discussion. If you would like to comment on any of it, I'll get to the details of the different stories. But the first thing I do want to talk about, let me see, I got about 5 minutes before we take a station identification break. Not sure how long I'm going to be on air tonight, to be honest with you. I'm not feeling all that great, but I'm going to try to stick it out. I usually am on for 3 hours. I don't know if I'm be able to make the whole 3 hours tonight, but hey, we'll see. But anyway, let's get to this main thing. Former CEO Obama, he left office again. R.G. Reed of CobrasInAction.org is their website, but he is a broadcaster, podcaster here on the Black Talk Radio Network. And he did a podcast where he was basing it off of this article that had 50 accomplishments or things attributed as accomplishments of President Obama. And so he went through the whole list, and he could only identify one thing that was specifically done for a subgroup of black people in this country. And that is that he signed whatever he needed to sign to approve those black farmers for getting their money in that lawsuit that they had filed against the United States Agriculture Department for practicing racism, denying them access to loans and things, forcing them to sell the farm, so to speak. And so these black farmers sued. And it during the Obama administration, I think it came to a head. I think Obama agreed to pay them. I don't know if Congress ever provided the funds to pay them, but that was attributed as something Barack Obama did for black people. That's a specific group within the group of those who are classified as black under this racist system. So I agree with R.G. Reed's assessment. If you want to talk about the Affordable Care Act, I don't have any interactions with it. I've had none. I'm a veteran, therefore I have VA health care. I was not forced to purchase any kind of health care under the penalty of law, which that is a big part of the ACA, which is the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. So I can't speak from personal experience. I don't know anyone. Both my daughters have insurance through their jobs. My mom's retired, so she got Medicare and Blue Cross Blue Shield, I think, you know, but that's kind of tied to her job that she retired from. So I don't know, but I have heard people on different programs talk about how expensive it is, especially if you're a small business owner or you're an entrepreneur, or, you know, you can't get it through an employer. Then again, if you live in one of those states, one of those red states that refuse to expand it under Medicaid, then, you know, you were left without insurance. You still can't get it and what have you. So that, though, I agree with R.G. Reed, that wasn't done specifically for black people. Was not done. It was done for everybody is supposed to have access for it, to that health care, and everybody is affected by the penalties if you don't get it. So I don't really have any critiques on that, except for what I heard. But again, that was not something I've heard people say, oh, he passed Obamacare for black people. That wasn't specific to black people. So, you know, I heard a lot of people complaining about his administration not doing anything to increase funding for the HBCUs, that's historically black colleges and universities. So, you know, can't put that on the list as what he did for black people. I really can't think of anything. I really cannot think of anything that he did. And so there was some hope that on his way out in his final days that he would do something. He would do something, even if it was something minor, even if it was something symbolic. We got nothing. We got nothing. That's it. We got zero. He released, he did some commutations and of political prisoners like Chelsea Manning, formerly known as Bradley Manning, I think. And that's the person who took that data. I think they had downloaded it from the military, one of the military computers, and it had images on there showing the military to be murdering people in Iraq. It had a whole lot of stuff on there. And so he went to prison for that, and President Obama commuted his sentence, okay? So I'm sure the LGBT community happy about that. I'm sure they don't have too many complaints about President Obama and what he did in terms of their issues. He did also commute the sentence of Oscar Lopez Rivera, I think is his name. He is a Puerto Rican independence fighter. He belonged to a group that was fighting for Puerto Rican independence. A lot of people don't know that Puerto Rico is an occupied island, just like the U.S. Virgin Islands, just like Hawaii, even though it's a state, they didn't ask to become part of the state. The United States invaded it with their military and took it over. And same thing with Puerto Rico. And some people just don't like people coming into their lands and taking over. And so Oscar Lopez Rivera was part, I forget the name of the group that he belonged to, but he was accused of setting off some dynamite and attacking some federal buildings or something to that effect. So he had been in prison for like over 30 years. President Obama, before leaving office, commuted his sentence. There were requests put in for various political prisoners who are black, who were part of the black struggle, who were either in the Black Panther Party, or later the Black Liberation Army, or like MOVE in Philadelphia. Now, MOVE in Philadelphia, that has to do, they were convicted on state charges, so the federal government, he couldn't pardon them or commute their sentences if he wanted to. But we do have some who are in federal custody, right? And again, I know most of the general public has never heard of COINTELPRO, but I think most of those who listen to Black Talk Radio, you have heard of COINTELPRO. And I'm not talking about just any kind of Black Talk Radio. I'm talking about this station specifically. I'm not talking about any of these black people on stations that belong to iHeart, formerly known as Clear Channel or CBS or NBC Radio or whatever. No, I'm talking about independent black radio. So y'all know what COINTELPRO is, or at least y'all have heard of it. And COINTELPRO stands for Counterintelligence Program. It was an illegal program that was run by the FBI. I think it started in the 1950s. And the stated goal of this program was to target, assassinate, and frame black leaders with the intent of preventing a messiah-like figure from arising that who would unite all black people despite their religious classifications, despite their political classifications, despite, you know, any of the individual things we might be engaged in, but bringing us together as a cohesive fighting unit to finally rid the planet of racism and white supremacy. So J. Edgar Hoover, the cross-dressing, possibly gay FBI director, came up with this program, and they engaged in assassinating people and framing people for crimes they didn't commit, or putting them in a situation where they were forced to defend their lives against murderous police, where they had to end up killing that police just to preserve their own lives, you know, put them in those sort of situations, and now they're in prison. Now, everybody know about COINTELPRO, everybody who's well read up on U.S. history, especially during that period. How can you not advocate for the release of these political prisoners? And then you talk about black leadership, and you talk about the black struggle, and you talk about black unity, but you're more than willing to leave our soldiers as prisoners of war on these prison plantations? Again, you know, I don't blame the average person that's listening, because you don't know what you don't know. And they doggone sure did not teach you about all of this in public school. They didn't teach it to you in private school. They ain't teaching it to you in no school here in America. They didn't teach that stuff to you unless you got lucky enough to have a radical teacher who would get that information to their students. You probably wouldn't find out about this kind of stuff till you got in college. And then, you know, even if you took an African-American study class, they still might not bring it up. So I don't blame the average person. Who I blame? I blame those who call themselves black leaders, because they're supposed to be the most informed about these issues. I blame John Lewis. I blame John Lewis for leaving his comrades behind, because they were out there struggling, out there fighting against the same system that he was fighting against. Okay? And so then, I guess after he seen Dr. King got assassinated, I guess he seen after all these brothers and sisters get put in prison or murdered by police, he was like, hey, I can't beat them, so I'm going to join them. So he became part of USA Inc. as a board member of Congress. And since he has become a board member, do you think he gives a damn about any of those people that's in prison, that's his age, that were out there on that battlefield just like him? No, he don't care about him. Never have I ever heard this man utter one word about political prisoners, but y'all want to give him kudos. Y'all want to hold him up as some kind of leader. What is he leading us on? What is he leading us into? Then that just says something about a person who has that kind of background, who has that kind of history, who knows what the United States government did and then became part of that government and did nothing to advocate for those people released. I blame every member of the Congressional Black Caucus. I don't want to hear any excuses. When Cynthia McKinney, before the Democrats threw her under the bus, when she was a congresswoman, she brought these issues up. There was calls for a Truth and Reconciliation Commission like they had in South Africa after the end of apartheid. And there were similar calls. I know Cynthia McKinney was one of those, for the same thing to happen here. They've admitted this. This is part of the congressional record. In the 70s, they had COINTELPRO hearings. But not, they didn't let anybody out. They did not free not a single political prisoner and not a single assassin, whether they was a police officer, whether they was an FBI agent or whatever law enforcement department they were working for, working with the FBI in the COINTELPRO operations. Not a single one of them went to prison. I think two of them went to prison. I think two of them went to prison on a technicality, not for any murders or anything like that. And then Ronald Reagan pardoned those FBI agents for their crimes involved with COINTELPRO. But those the only two. So we get, quote unquote, the first black president, which I don't know why people call him that when he's rejected that. He told you, I ain't the African-American president. I ain't the white president. I'm the president of everybody. I'm the president of the United States of America Incorporated. But, you know, yeah, he's melanated. He is classified as black under the system, whether he accepts the term or not. But that just goes to show you that he really isn't connected to us. He really isn't connected to the struggle, the long time, the hundreds years old struggle for black freedom in this country. Because if he was, you would have think with him going out the door, nothing nobody else can do to him, he would have let at least a couple of these brothers out. He did no such thing. He did no such thing. And that's just pitiful, man. That's just pitiful. That's sad. And you know, there was really no mass push for him to release any of these people. The political prisoner advocacy community is very, very small. And they're not all black. There are a lot of white people that's advocating for these political prisoners to get out. But there has been no mass coordinated effort from any organizations like the NAACP, like the Urban League. You know, it may not fall under the mission of the Urban League, but none of these organizations, not Congress people, a Congressional Black Congress, which is an oxymoron, but no organization to get these people out, even though you know they are being held unjustly. So it's unlikely that they will get out. I'm sorry to say that. I would like to have hope, but at the same time, I'm a realist. I would like to be presently surprised and see somebody go to Donald Trump and say, hey, Donald Trump, if you want to repair your image with black people or whatever, let these people go. Let them go. Let our people go. It could happen, but it's not likely to happen. But the same demands that was put on him, on Obama, should be put on Trump to let our people go. But it just seems that, you know, Obama was their last best chance, and they really didn't have a chance, because he ain't connected. He ain't connected to the black struggle. He really isn't. So his only struggle has been in politics. He ain't experienced the personal things that our families experience every day. All right. So another thing he could have done for black people, even though black people don't use cannabis no more than anybody else, but he could have removed cannabis from the DEA scheduled list of dangerous drugs. He didn't. He didn't do that. He was asked to do that. He said, if y'all want it done, pass a bill. You know, quite cynically, he added. And I'm like, you know what? You bragged about how much pot you used to smoke. Your daughter just was seen smoking dope. I shouldn't say smoking dope. Smoking cannabis at a concert. You know they've been using this plant to target people. Plant, even if people don't have cannabis, they plant it on them. You could have removed that. Did he do it? No, he didn't do it. So, you know, I'm like this. Bye, Obama. Bye. Don't let the door hit you where the good Lord split you. Bye. Because you ain't do nothing for us but confuse a whole bunch of black folks. I'm even hearing people in their 60s. You ask them, what Barack Obama do for the black voting constituency? Oh, he went to his job every day with a suit on. Like, really? Really? That's what you consider an accomplishment? Is having a high profile black man in a 3-piece suit or whatever, nice clothes? That, like, we don't have that. I can show you plenty of lynching pictures where them brothers was dressed clean to the T in their Sunday best and still got lynched. As if black people is walking around, you know, looking raggedy or whatnot. I'm just, man. So it's unlikely that these brothers and sisters is going to get set free. Under a Trump administration, anything's possible, but that's highly unlikely. I plan to continue to give my support and do whatever I can to those involved in the movement to set these people free. But I tell you, Obama couldn't have gotten out of office soon enough for me. You're listening to Black Talk Radio News. This is a weekly radio program airing on the Black Talk Radio Network, the world's number one independent black digital radio and podcasting platform. Going to take a station identification break, and then when we come back, we will take a look at this article that showed up on ebony.com. You have this professor of African American studies saying that we need to organize around three issues for the long-term future, that being education, jobs, and criminal justice. Stay tuned. We will be right back.
Black Talk Radio Network is made possible in part with help from the Black Talk Media Project, a North Carolina-based nonprofit engaged in the production and distribution of independent digital black media. Find out more by going to blacktalkradionetwork.com or blacktalkmediaproject.org and look for the menu tab, Crowdfunding Black Media. Black Talk Media Project, helping to provide you with new black media for the new millennium. to Black Talk Radio, new black media for the new millennium.
And welcome back to Black Talk Radio News. Scotty Reed in on this broadcast from behind these enemy lines that I call USA Inc. Again, today's date is January 21st, 2017, almost through the first month of the new year already, man. I don't know if it's because I'm older now, a little bit older, turned 50 in 2016, if time just seems to be speeding up or something, I don't know. Anyway, Ebony.com published a piece which was written by Eddie S. Glaude Jr. Mr. Glaude, if I can get this web page to act right, since it's jumping around, he is the chair of the Department of African American Studies at Princeton University, one of those white supremacist universities built on slavery. So that's where he goes to, that's where he teaches school. He published this piece titled, man, this web page, The Way Forward. It's time for a different kind of politics. He says, as the political landscape changes with a new White House, so must we. So let's see what he's talking about here. He says he's from Mississippi. The night Donald Trump was elected president, my first reaction was, look at what these white folks have done. The second was, while this is certainly a moment of crisis, it is also one of possibility. He says we need to focus on three areas that have a bearing on the long-term future of our communities: education, jobs, and criminal justice. He says if Trump's nominee for Secretary of Education, I saw a little bit of those confirmation hearings. Betsy DeVos is confirmed, is going to change the landscape of education. We're going to have to adopt a strategy for the ballot box and one for the streets, both designed and executed by local organizers. Organizers are going to have to figure out who they're going to run for the local school board, who they're going to run for office that holds a vision of public education as a public good, and who they're going to run that can push back against the forces of privatization. To bring these issues to the forefront will require wildcat strikes on the part of students and teach-ins on the part of those of us who are allied with public education. It's going to require a kind of coalition building among progressives outside and inside public education. So let's take a look at this. Look, I was just having this conversation with my daughter, and I mentioned this before. I wish, I told my daughter, my oldest daughter, this week, I said, I wish I had known then what I know now, and I wouldn't have sent y'all to these schools around here. It's not that the schools are terrible in terms of lacking resources or anything like that. We live in a predominantly white area. Those white kids gonna get all the resources they need. So, you know, so the schools that around here, they're not really lacking resources that I can tell. So that wasn't it. But I told her it's because they gave you a white supremacist worldview, just like they gave me a white supremacist worldview. And that's the truth about public education. And I told her, please take my grandson out of that school. I will do whatever I need to do to help you to homeschool him. But it is not that hard. We're already doing a lot of work with him with all the homework they sent home. I mean, what's the point of having homework if they can't, you know, all that homework that they send? And not saying that kids shouldn't have, the children shouldn't have homework, but they be sending home too much homework. And I'm like, well, what did they teach you at school that you got all this homework? You know, and so since we're already doing that, let's kill two birds with one stone. We'll be the teacher, you know, all the way around. We won't need anybody else. And so in North Carolina, they have a pretty strong homeschooling community that you can reach out to. I've done programs on here, And I told her there is a online black homeschooling community that you can tie into that shares resources and will help you. And so she was really giving it some serious thoughts, some serious thought. So this is the thing, though. Why do we want to save public schools when they ain't nothing but a pipeline to prison for our kids? They not teaching real history. They teaching selective history. They teaching white history. They teaching white supremacist history. This is why our kids have low self-esteem. Y'all, excuse me. I know kids is another word for a goat, but I'm in the South. We use that term for children. Okay. So anyway, what are they teaching our children? But a bunch of lies. And I told my daughter, I said, you remember how you felt when Colin Kaepernick was not, you know, standing up for the national anthem and that whole thing was going on? And then you had went to the school for something and you said you had never seen this before, but everybody just stopped in place as they playing the national anthem. I mean, standing around in the parking lot, standing around in the building and while the national anthem is being played. And I said, what was your reaction? She was like, I don't know why they playing that. I'm not stopping. I'm going to keep walking. Because I agree with what Kaepernick was saying about this was written by a slaver, a man who was practicing slavery. And he wrote a song. Even though they removed the lyrics, the song was about killing black people who dared fight against these devils for their freedom. So she didn't stop. She just went on to the office and what have you. And I said, okay then, you see, they are teaching these children to be little robots, to always stand to attention like they in the military when the national anthem is played. It's all about teaching them to conform. And my grandson, he takes after his mother, and his mother takes, and I'm talking about my oldest grandson because I got three, but my oldest grandson takes after his mother. His mother takes after me. And in terms of, we have very strong personalities, all right? And we do not shy away from confrontation and just very, very strong spirits. And so I was telling her that, you know, because they tried to say that he's had some behavioral issues and whatnot. For example, they were in gym class. He wanted some water. The teacher said he couldn't have no water. He was like, I want some water and I'm going to get some water. And he went and got some water. So they tried to put him in and make him walk some laps. And this is like a 6-year-old child, right? Try to make him walk laps and stuff. Like, he wouldn't do it. He wouldn't do it. So they call her up there. I said, they trying to kill his spirit. That's what they trying to do. They trying to force him to conform. I said, he is not. I said, he will learn social skills and he'll learn how to interact with other people and things, because he's doing nothing any different at school than he does here at home. And yes, he needs to be corrected when he does something wrong, but they are building a record on him. That's what they will do. They'll put that all in his little file and whatnot, and it won't be forgotten about. They'll look at it. It'll follow him all throughout his school. And she thought hard about what I was saying. So I'm not feeling this guy when he talking about organizing to protect public education as a public good when it's a public evil. And I dare anyone to try, not that I dare, not that I'm saying I want someone to confront me, but I challenge anyone to debate me on the merit of public education. My God, they're still teaching that slavery was abolished, that Lincoln freed the slaves in 1865. And that's not what the Constitution says. They're telling us that, hey, slavery was over. Nobody's a slave anymore. We have all this freedom, all this liberty. You can be anything you want to be. There's nothing holding you back. And that's a bald-faced lie. It's a bald-faced lie. Slavery still exists. and it is bigger and badder than ever at any time in U.S. history. So why are we protecting schools for? What do we want to protect these public schools for? They got a name. What do we call them? We call it the school to prison pipeline. Then what we were reporting on New Abolitionist Radio in Missouri, where they passed this law to where they can start charging kindergartners, little kids, with felonies for getting in school fights. Why do you want to subject your child to that system? And I apologize to my daughter. I apologize to her. They came out okay. They came out okay, you know, because I always was very involved with their education, and I would tell them, oh, that's a lie. You know, this is the real deal about Thanksgiving. You know, no, slavery was not abolished. Well, I wasn't telling them that because I didn't know until about 4 or 5 years ago myself because of the education I got from public school. So I just don't see this. I don't see any value. Now, here in North Carolina, which is totally controlled by Republicans, they recently passed legislation that allow us to get vouchers to where we could send our kids to any school we want to send them to using these public vouchers, these school vouchers. Now, again, I don't, if it's a charter school, a private school, whatever, if they still teaching a white supremacist worldview, if they still teaching that slavery was abolished and it was not abolished, then, you just pulling them out of one system and putting them in the same system, just a different building. Not going to be telling them the truth. They're going to be leaving black people, writing black people and non-white people out of the history of the founding of this country, over the building of this country. So, you know, to me, that's not an option. Now, it does present an opportunity for black people to come together and start our own charter schools like some black people have done. So it just seems to me that this Princeton professor is solidly in the liberal camp or the Democratic camp because that's all we hear from Democrats. And I was asking myself, why do so many black people get into this issue about public schools? And I was thinking about it the other day when we were discussing something about, or I was listening to somebody discuss how a lot of black people got jobs in the federal government and that they're the biggest employer of black people is the federal government. And so I was thinking that's probably why black teachers want to save the public schools because they dependent on it for a job. They dependent on it for a job. I have not seen an uprising among black teachers to start pushing more historically accurate school curriculum. I don't see a push. I don't see no big stink raised about it. No, I don't see any of that. Oh, I do hear them talking about school closings because that means if a school closed, they lose a job, right? So it just seems to me that these people might just only be thinking about themselves. And I got teachers in my family. My sister's a teacher. My cousin that lives next door is a teacher. So, I know people that's working in that, but again, this ain't a system worth saving, in my opinion. If it is, in fact, producing children that's likely to end up in prison, why you want to say that? Why do we want to voluntarily submit our children to racism and a white supremacist worldview? So I would find myself on the other issue, on the other side of the issue with this man. Because I don't think public education is worth fighting for or saving. Now, he says that we need to do something similar around jobs. And I probably will agree with him on this. We do need a jobs bill. pertaining to the infrastructure. President Obama tried to, at least I heard he tried to, get a jobs bill through Congress, and they wouldn't sign it. He had a Republican Congress after, what, the midterms of his first year? And so, you know, they spent the first 2 years passing the Affordable Care Act, and that was about it. That's about the only thing he was able to get through. But anyway, this professor is saying, man, this website is tripping. We need to organize around jobs. I agree. He says, since Trump is talking about rebuilding America's infrastructure, we've got to position ourselves to get some of those new jobs. We've got to ask what it means to organize for a livable wage. There are organizers in the South who are working hard to link white and black workers across the tracks, such as the extraordinary work we see the Reverend William Barber II doing in North Carolina as part of the Ford Together movement. Even though the state whip for Trump is residents voted out Republican Governor Pat McCrory and have been engaged in a kind of electoral politics that isn't reducible to simply electing people. They've also been organizing around public education, undocumented workers, the right of women to choose, prison reform, staging a movement that cuts across a variety of constituencies and emphasizes the power of everyday ordinary people. He really didn't talk a whole lot about organizing around jobs, but if Donald Trump wants to pass a $1 trillion infrastructure bill, I think that black folks should be calling these people and say, we want that too. We want that too. Because we are the most unemployed in this country. I used to do construction work. They are not lying to you when they tell you that the infrastructure in the United States is crumbling. I remember one time in Georgia, Sardis, Georgia, down there in Sardis, Georgia. That's where I got hurt. That's why I remember it. Working on a bridge down there that was built in the 1920s. I'm like, what? For real? 1920s? This thing has sandbags under it. That was part of its foundation. Sandbags. So, yes, we do need to rebuild the infrastructure in America, and I support this job infrastructure bill that Donald Trump is asking for, and Democrats should be working with him. We should be telling whoever the board member of Congress is that's over our district, that was elected from our district, we need to tell them to work with Donald Trump on this. Now, again, this also brings to my mind about some of the childishness I've been seeing and witnessing in terms of some of these black Democrats who talking about, oh, Trump ain't legitimate, and pushing these lies about the Russians hacking the elections, and you know, just a whole bunch of political theater that ain't solving nobody's problem. Ain't even highlighting a real problem. And he ain't doing it. I'm talking about John Lewis. And he ain't doing it for black people. He doing it for Hillary Clinton. All right. So if they are going to take that sort of, let's say, posture towards Donald Trump, then how are they going to push for these bills, work with him to get this bill passed so black folks can get jobs? Because like somebody pointed out, the doggone unemployment rate in Atlanta is probably about 50% for black people, John Lewis. So stop with the political posturing. Work on getting your constituents some jobs in Atlanta. Because we know the crime that we see in Atlanta is linked to the poverty in Atlanta. So I agree. We do need to organize around pushing for a jobs bill. I couldn't agree more on that. The third thing that they're talking about is criminal justice. That he's talking about, I should say. There's one thing in here that I do agree with. It's something I've been pushing for a long time, is jury nullification. Jury nullification has its roots in hundreds of years of law, but particularly in this country when it came to the Fugitive Slave Act. I think it was the Fugitive Slave Act of 1860, I believe is when that was passed. But what it was, a federal law that says if you assist an enslaved African in helping them to escape to freedom and you get caught, that's a crime and we're going to put you in prison. So when they had their jury trials, those juries would vote not guilty, even though the person may have even admitted that they did it and would do it again. They would, again, help enslaved Africans. So the juries in some of those counties said, you know what? We don't agree with slavery, and we don't think that there should be a law criminalizing people who help people escape from slavery, so we're voting not guilty. That's what jury nullification is. You nullify the law. All right? We should have been practicing this. We should have been practicing this because, you know what? No, now, most of the people that's in prison, most of the cases, I should say, that go through court, 95+% of them end up in plea bargains because they threaten the person with so much time, and then they'll stack charges on them, and then they'll be like, but if you agree to plead guilty, we'll give you these lesser charges and what have you. So they'll plead guilty, and they end up, you know, however many years a slave for cannabis possession or something like that, right? Whereas if they took it to court, they might give somebody a chance to say, you know what? Yeah, he had that cannabis. Yeah, he had that weed. But guess what? I don't think that the United States government has a right to tell a person what plant they can use and what plant they cannot use. I don't think that they should be telling people what they can and cannot put in their body. You know, he did not sell any drugs to children, so I'm voting not guilty. Not guilty. We should have been engaging in this. They should have a long time ago been putting this out to black people. But what do we get? We want to be good Americans. It's our duty to base this case on the law and not judge whether the law is wrong or not, but the law is the law and we want law and order and y'all just don't know the law. Is what I heard some people say. The law is evil, the law is unjust, and the law was put in place specifically to increase the number of slaves on the plantation. So I agree with him that we do need to stop trying to get out of jury duty if we're doing that, and that we should stop, if we're on these juries, stop sending people to prison over nonviolent so-called crimes, which aren't crimes because they have no victim. They didn't victimize another person. And as he writes, also stop convicting children as adults. So I agree with him in terms of that in pertaining to the criminal justice system. In terms of the Voting Rights Act and him talking about affirmative action is about to be gutted, I feel like this. I don't think affirmative action has benefited me ever in my life, period. I don't think it has. And I think the facts will show, the statistical data will show, that affirmative action has benefited white women more than anyone. So I really don't care about something that ain't really helping me. I really don't care about having a few showcase token Negroes working for these big corporations, and I don't care about that. I don't care. Affirmative action ain't really benefited me I don't see that it's benefiting my children. So, I mean, what's the point? It benefiting white women the most, and therefore the white family. It ain't benefiting us. The Voting Rights Act. I don't know how I feel about that. All right. Because I've never been without an ID. But I do understand that older people, some elderly people, especially 70s, 80s, whatnot, they may not have all their documentation to get an ID. I think that they should receive special waivers in order to vote if that's what they want to do. But I don't see what's so hard about, even in the states, like where they're supposed to give you a free ID. What's the problem? I really don't see that as a problem. I also don't see voting fraud as a problem either. So I don't know why, you know, the Republicans insist on these voter ID laws. But again, you know, the Voting Rights Act, I don't really know that it's providing any kind of protection for us anyway. I'm not sure on that one. But I don't see the Voting Rights Act having anything to do with the criminal justice system. Other than once you've been a slave on a federal plantation and stuck with a felony, that your voting rights in many of these states are taken away for life. So that's the only thing I see voting has to do with the criminal justice system, directly or indirectly. I might be wrong about that. So what I'm not hearing from this man, who is a Princeton professor, he's the chair of the Department of African American Studies, Eddie S. Glaw Jr. What I'm not hearing is anything about modern day slavery and human trafficking. He doesn't even mention mass incarceration in here. So like I said, it is a very short piece, very short piece. But I thought that it had an interesting title, that you got a different president now, so you need to adopt a different tactic, at least he's not telling people not to engage the administration. Doesn't sound like he's telling people that. And in terms of the black community, I hope that their approach in dealing with Trump is going to be different than under Obama, because we didn't ask Obama, and I'm talking in general terms, we didn't ask Obama for a damn thing except to be black. That's all. That ain't how you play politics. That ain't why people engage in politics. People engage in politics to get something done from the government, to get something from the government. That's why people engage in politics, not for symbolic figureheads and things of that nature. And so the Black Political Caucus, they didn't press him on reparations. I don't see that they pressed him on ending slavery. I don't see that they pressed him on anything pertinent to black people, except maybe they might have put a little word in his ear about the black farmers who were discriminated against getting their money. Barack Obama did more for the Hawaiian independence movement than he did for black freedom in this country. Again, he, through the Interior Department, gave them the option to vote, have a vote, and determine whether or not they want to still continue to be part of the United States, considering that the way they was brought into the United States was illegal. They kidnapped the queen, held her at gunpoint, threatened to kill her and members of her family if she didn't sign documents turning over Hawaii to them. So he gave them that option. He's done stuff for people. He's done stuff for victims of racism. He just ain't done crap for black folks. United States, considering that. Uh-oh, sorry about that. I was opening up trying to get to my other stories, and I see that audio was going. I agree with him about... No, not really. You don't have to change your tactics. Your tactics should be the same whoever is in power. whether it be a Democrat, whether it be a Republican, whether it be a man, woman, whether it be a white person, a black person, or a Hispanic person. That shouldn't matter. They represent the United States of America. All right? And we should be making the same demands on each and every one of them. Whether that's a demand for reparations, whether that's a demand for ending slavery, nothing should change. Now, it may be some nuances to your tactics, but you have to put demands on them. And that's the only good thing that I see about a Trump administration, is that now it has mobilized a whole bunch of complacent people who were just more than happy just to have a black family in the White House and wasn't really engaged in the political process that much anyway throughout those 8 years. So that's good. That's good to see that. All right. So let me go ahead and take a station identification break. The telephone number, if you have a question or comment, is 866-510-9025. 866-510-9025. Anytime you'd like to jump in, hit **. That will unmute you on the board, or you can just hang out and listen. We got plenty of room for that. All right, we'll be back on the other side. This is Black Talk Radio News. Scotty Reed broadcasting from behind the enemy lines of USA Inc.
Black Talk Radio, your choice for digital black radio. New black media for the new millennium.
And welcome back to BTR News. This is a weekly program that comes on every Saturday at 7 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time. I usually broadcast for about 3 hours. I think I've started broadcasting. I may not be able to do that three tonight, but I'll keep going. Who knows? Let's see. Next story. What will foreign policy look like under the Trump administration? Like I was saying earlier, will the United States military continue to find itself in military conflict after military conflict after military conflict, which has been consistent since World War II? This country has consistently been involved in a war one way or another. I believe that this has led to the population decline of white males in this country. Okay? If they continue these nonstop wars, are we looking at an extinction level event for white males in the United States if they keep this up? I don't know. But it doesn't look good. It doesn't look good. So you have now all of these confrontations going on with China, with Russia, them lying on Russia. There is stuff going on with Iran. They're now threatening to tear up the nuclear agreement with Iran. So what will the foreign policy look like under Donald Trump? Well, Ron Paul, a man who I learned a lot about the inner workings of the system from, he feels that they are going to continue to escalate war so they can justify spending money on the military and spending all, you know, coming up with new weaponry and money for new troops and all that kind of good stuff. They'll come up with bonuses to entice you to join. Yeah, we'll give you $10,000 if you join the military. We'll send you off to war, and you may not make it back, but you know, you'll still have that $10,000 in the bank. You know, you might be maimed or half your skull blown off, but you still have that $10,000 in the bank. So anyway, former U.S. presidential candidate and Congressman Ron Paul said that there is a neoconservative axis of evil, and I added the evil part, a neoconservative axis of evil in the Senate made up of John McCain, Lindsey Graham, and Tom Cotton, which might destroy America by increasing the military spending up to $5 trillion over the next 5 years. Well, you know what, Ron Paul? I'm all for that. If it's going to destroy America, yeah, let's do it. Let's go for it. Because, you know, I make it no secret. I want to see the corporation dissolved, and I want us to start over with something brand new, something, a government that isn't founded on slavery and practicing racism, white supremacy. So, hey, if that's what it takes, if that's what it takes to destroy this system, let them. Is what I say. But, you know, Ron Paul, he doesn't want to see America destroyed. He wants what's best for quote unquote Americans, and he's never been one for all these wars and whatnot. He's pretty much been consistent with wanting peace. He is the founder of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. The Washington Post, you may have saw that article where they were talking about all these outlets talking about they putting out fake news simply because they were telling the truth about Hillary. Well, Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity was on that list, along with Black Agenda Report. Shout out to Margaret Kimberly. I love that piece you just wrote about John Lewis, about we can no longer allow him to be using this civil rights card like he's above criticism when he ain't doing nothing for Black people, let alone the Black people that he's supposed to be representing out of Georgia. Anyway, he says that the Senate Armed Services Chairman has published a Senator John McCain has published a 35-page white paper, Restoring American Power. Now, that sounds something similar to another paper I read called Rebuilding America's Defenses. And in this paper, which was also put together by a bunch of neoconservatives and sent to President Clinton at the time, where they were talking about creating race-specific weapons where they can target people and kill them by their race based off of genetic markers. This is the type of stuff people in your government talk about. And you want to tell me that these are good people and they're not Nazis? Come on, give me a break. See, that's because y'all don't read what these people be writing. And if the mainstream corporate state media don't tell you about it, you don't know about it because you don't take the time to seek out independent alternative media that'll tell you about these things and tell you where to find it so you can read it for yourself. So Rebuilding America Defenses was written in the 1990s. You can Google that and find the PDF file online. Many of these people that wrote that is still in power today. So now we got John McCain coming out with his own paper. And in this, he says the U.S. military must achieve the capability of waging and winning conventional warfare in three priority theaters: Asia, Europe, and the Middle East. Why? Why? Why, John McCain? Because John McCain never saw a war that he did not want to send somebody else's child off to fight in. Who's threatening us in Asia? Who's threatening you in Europe? Who's threatening people in the Middle East? But the United States, practicing racism and white supremacy, trying to implement hedge money in these areas. So in the paper, the hawkish senator also outlined his plans to counter the new threats of battlefield nuclear weapons, cyber attacks, and irregular warfare, which would cost $430 billion more than current plans over 5 years. Last month, Congress passed the U.S. military budget of $618 billion for the next fiscal year. Where they be finding all this money at? Oh, yeah, that's your money. They spending your grandchildren's future. And they taking your reparations money. Your free college money. So let me just run this clip. Let me see how long it is. And hear what Dr. Paul had to say about these neocons, John McCain, Lindsey Graham, and Tom Cotton. All right, let's get this up.
Hello, everybody. Thank you for tuning in to the Liberty Report. With me today is Daniel McAdams. Daniel, good to see you.
Good morning, Dr. Paul.
Good. We want to talk about spending. That is, there's too much of it. But there's a major paper came out just recently from the leader of the neocons in the Senate. You know, there's a neocon axis in the Senate made up of McCain, Graham, and Cotton.
Yes.
And they're the three top dogs there. And they have declared that we are in great danger. We are going to be attacked, and we're unprepared. We have no weaponry. We don't spend enough money. And therefore, their proposal, simple, $5 trillion in the next 5 years, just on the military, rebuild the military. Sounds like maybe Donald Trump might like this. He's been arguing the case. Even though these guys are neocons, I don't think Trump has earned that title. You know, so how does this come together, which will be interesting. But $5 trillion is what they want to spend to rebuild the military, claiming that we're in great danger and that we have to be prepared to fight three wars at a time. And I would think that maybe we probably have enough power to defend ourselves. I can't imagine anybody attacking us. Where's the attack going to come from? I used to kid back in the middle of the Cold War when we really did have a threat from the Soviets. I said, wonder where they wanted to build a lot more tanks. I said, wonder where the tank attacks are going to come down through Alaska or something. And sometimes they live in the dark ages about weaponry, and I think a little bit of that might be happening right now. $5 trillion, are they building weapons for purely defense? Is that what they were talking about, or are they talking about something else?
Yeah, the question is really, you know, this is a new 35-page white paper that McCain released about what our military budget should be. And the real question we had when coming up with this topic is, on the one hand, Donald Trump said we need to rebuild our military, make it the strongest. He's been critical of some weapon systems, but overall, he said we need to rebuild the military. Will, you know, this be a way of healing the wounds? Because McCain and Trump have not been friends, not in the slightest. Will this be where they come together? And if so, who will be the big enemy? Because Trump has talked about wanting to have better relations with Russia. How do you justify having such a huge military?
Yeah, I just don't think the military and militarism is going to be diminished in the administration, because we have a couple generals there that, are there for a purpose, but they're also influenced, as usual, by those individuals in the weapons industry. And they talk to them all the time. And sometimes it's just, you know, a matter of spending, more spending. And they equate spending with defense. And I keep thinking, well, we have to be strong, but maybe we have to be strong financially. You know, everybody claims that the Soviet system was demolished by the military buildup of Ronald Reagan. And I understand their argument, and I don't jump all over that, but quite frankly, I think there was a lot more to it than that, because I think it was the predictable failure of communism and socialism that made it impossible for them to be stretched out, have poor production at home, and they went bankrupt is what happened. So when they talk about these weapons making America strong again, and this is what we need, do they ever look at the other side of the equation? Well, maybe financially it's going to destroy us, and that's how most empires end anyway. But they don't really talk about that. They talk about the immediate. And this, to me, isn't even new in my lifetime. I remember very clearly the election with Kennedy in 1960, and he was talking about, you know, the missile gap. Here he was, a liberal Democrat, thought to be leaning toward less government and militarism, and he really played on that. And this is very similar. So it's been going on for a long time. It scared the people. They're coming to get us. They're going to attack us. And if you don't do it, you're unpatriotic. And only a patriot can understand exactly what McCain wants. And he would like to take that. But I don't know whether these three, the neocon axis, will be able to maintain their credibility. That's really the question.
Yeah, the other question is, how patriotic is it to destroy the economy? We'll be very much weaker if the economy is...
All right, I'm going to stop it there. Man, I'm just really off on my brakes. But, yeah, I want the corporation to crumble. As you heard Ron Paul say, this is what happened to the Roman Empire. You spread yourself thin all over the world. You can't afford to pay for the occupation of all these foreign lands. And then you go bankrupt, and then your empire crumbles. I only hope that this happens in the next 4 years. Let them spend that $5 trillion. The reason we brought Tando Radio to this network is because he comes from the prepper community, preparing for disasters, and that includes the eventual collapse of the United States, because he cannot continue on his present course, and so we need to be prepared. That's why I brought him to the network, so that we can be learning the things we need to learn about preparing for the eventual collapse of the United States. They're not going to talk to you about this in mainstream media. They're not. All right. What they're going to do is play you Republicans against Democrats, Democrats against Republicans, liberals against conservatives, conservatives against. Just keep, you know, people at each other, to where then you're not paying attention to what the real people in power is doing. All right. So that's what he thinks could happen with, especially John McCain and Lindsey Graham. Lindsey Graham, I came across a podcast I did 4 years ago in two, I think it was in 2011. I know this was right after the invasion of Libya. And I mentioned Lindsey Graham in that podcast, because I listened to it yesterday, and I was sharing Minister Farrakhan's interview. I took like 5 minutes from the interview, and he was calling Obama a traitor for murdering Gaddafi and whatnot. But you had Lindsey Graham, I also mentioned, because he was out there pushing, along with John McCain, to overthrow Libya based on what? Based on lies. Based on lies. All right. And then he was talking about, yeah, after we get through overthrowing Libya, we can go in there and do business. Well, it ain't quite worked out like that, with jihadists pretty much in control of the country. So I'm just saying, people, we need to know about these things so that we can prepare for the eventual collapse. In terms of the CIA and the intelligence services, this is a little side issue. I've been seeing today, I heard today that Donald Trump referred to the CIA as Nazis. And I was like, really? If he did, that was certainly an accurate description. As the the senator who was elected from my own district, when they had those Senate hearings talking about Russia interfered in the elections, which is absolute BS. All right. He said that he cited the work of some professor that had researched and found that the CIA, U.S. government had interfered since World War II in 81 elections around the world. And that doesn't even include the regime changes like they just did to Libya. Okay. Doesn't even include that. So I'm seeing everybody going after Donald Trump. Oh, he's so unpatriotic. These people risking their lives and to keep America safe and all that. Like Donald Trump said the first time. These same people that lied to us and said Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction and we ran up in there. And he did not have weapons of mass destruction. And so, you know, it just pains me when I hear black people doing their best parrot impression of these people on television. It's like all they got to do is put something on that screen. Like on that screen, it was talking about former CIA chief calls Trump comments unpatriotic or something like that. And so that'll be the talking point that I'll hear from some black people on black radio. They'll be repeating the same stuff and not really giving any thought to it. Is what Donald Trump, just cause he's a racist, don't mean he ain't telling the truth about some stuff. And they absolutely are Nazis. These are the people that ran Operation Mockingbird. Go look it up. It's very important to read. Go look up Operation Mockingbird. That was a CIA operation working with who? Working with mainstream media to propagandize the American public, to tell you lies, to get you into war so that rich people can make even more money while your children get maimed and get killed. So I hope his prediction does come true. I hope they spend trillions and trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars, and then this so-called republic will break up and we can establish something better. Again, something not built on racism, something not built on slavery, something that is built on justice for all. All right. So, next story that I want to move to is this article. Speaking of slavery, I do feel like we in the abolitionist community are seeing progress in terms of changing the language on how criminal justice issues are talked about in this country. So you got this article that was published on Bloomberg.com. Bloomberg is a financial publication owned by the rich billionaire, what's his name, Michael Bloomberg. I think he was the one-time mayor of New York City. He lives in New York. This is his publication. It is a mainstream publication. It mostly focuses on, you know, business, the business world and what have you. So this article that was written by this person by the name of Noah Smith, when I saw the headline, I had to look at it again at who published this, because I will see these type of headlines come from alternative blogs and alternative media as they are starting to pick up on using the correct language. But I had never seen a mainstream, and when I say mainstream, I'm just simply the accepted corporations that people give deference to. So anyway, Noah Smith wrote this article, says, "Turning prisoners into slaves doesn't deter crime." Now, I haven't had a chance to actually read most of it, but just him alone using that headline and his editors allowing him to publish it under that headline really says a lot to me. Really says a lot in terms of the propaganda wars. So let me share some of this. In recent years, people have started to notice that the economics discipline is turning away from pure theory and toward a more empirical approach. But this isn't just an academic curiosity. It has real positive consequences for people's lives. Economic theory, if unchecked by data, can easily lead to very bad policy decisions. For a good example, consider a recent paper in the National Bureau of Economic Research by Stanford University law professor A. Mitchell Polinsky. The author isn't primarily an academic economist. He has a courtesy appointment at Stanford's economic department, but the legal profession now has many people working at the intersection of the two disciplines, with Judge Richard Posner being the most famous example. Polinsky's paper entitled "Prison Work Programs in a Model of Deterrence" says that making prisoners work without pay can help deter crime by making prison more unpleasant. So this guy, what's his name, Polinsky, is a piece of trash. He's probably white and probably a white supremacist. And he definitely supports slavery, as if prisoners are getting paid. And the ones who are getting paid slave wages, because that's where the term comes from. It's pre-1865 slavery. Some enslaved Africans, particularly if they were skilled in like, let's say, in textiles, like a dressmaker is a woman I read about. She made dresses and sold dresses. And her enslaver would allow her to keep a portion of the money while all the rest went to him, of course. But she saved up her money, her slave wages, And she bought her freedom later on and became an abolitionist working to free other people. So that's where the term slave wages come from. It means that some slaves were actually paid a wage. All right. So that term slave wages is being misused, in my opinion, today when you refer to people making minimum wage. That's not slave wages. You may say it's not enough, but they are not slaves. So they're not getting slave wages. They may not be getting living wages, but they're not slaves. They can choose to walk out of that factory or that hamburger joint or that department store they're working in at any time. They can quit. They can turn in their resignation. A slave cannot do that. So they're not getting slave wages. So this guy is sick, though. He's sick. Like they're having parties in prison. You know, a lot of people don't know, but men lead all groups as rape victims because of prison slavery in this country. It's not women. It's not girls. It's men. Men are the number one rape victims in this country because of prison. So I don't know what this dude is talking about how much more unpleasant can you make it? Serving these people, you know, rotten food, subjecting them to all kind of diseases and what have you. So anyway, many people, he goes on to write, many people already object to prison labor on moral grounds. Forced labor, though allowed by the Constitution, is a form of slavery. Now, he does not point out the 13th Amendment, but he is acknowledging that the Constitution allows for a form of slavery. That is why the United Nations human rights or language on slavery in the Declaration of Human Rights says we will abolish slavery in all its forms. It takes on different forms. Okay? So he is rightly pointing out, without mentioning the 13th Amendment, that forced labor, which is slavery, is allowed under the United States Constitution. He goes on to write, since smoking marijuana, for example, is a federal crime, this means that if you ever smoke, the U.S. government has the legal right to enslave you. I don't like that one bit. Polinsky, perhaps wary of advocating this extreme policy, also constructs a model in which voluntary work programs also serve a deterrent function. But the real problem with his paper isn't its lack of a moral grounding. Economics research often deals with difficult choices and dubious policies, but its illusion of plausibility. Polinsky used what he calls a standard model of how punishment deters crime. I mean, what fool? Again, this is why I don't respect people simply because they got PhDs or they went to this school or that school. All right, because I've seen plenty of people with PhDs talk pure nonsense. All right. They talk pure nonsense. You went to school to be a lawyer. All right. That does not make you a historian professor. You went to school to study statistics. That does not make you an authority on slavery in this country. Again, you know, I'm not saying that you have to have a degree to study anything. What I'm saying is you don't need one to study it, because these people go to these schools and they get these degrees that they're probably still trying to pay off their college loans. And guess what? Them degrees ain't worth nothing. And the stuff that's coming out their mouth, you might as well not even went to school, because you sound just as uneducated as everybody else. So here is this man who's going to get respect just because he's at this prestigious college and on this particular committee and all of that. But I mean, who can say that punishment deters crime? Has the death penalty stopped people from killing people? Has it deterred anyone from killing anyone? No, it didn't. Did the possibility of the death penalty deter Dylann Roof from walking into that church and murdering them people? No, it did not. You can put laws on the books all you want to all day long. They do not deter crime. You make anything you want illegal. Doesn't mean people going to adhere to that. So again, if this man thinks that crime and punishment, you know, punishment provides some kind of deterrent, he is sadly mistaken. If you want to prevent crime, you have to address the needs of the people who are likely to be put in a situation to where they have to commit crimes of survival. But again, I will stress to you that if there is no victim, there is no crime. If a person smokes marijuana, show me the victim. Show me who his victim is or her victim is. Now, if they had a child and that child's like 10 years old and they're making that child smoke blunts, a crime has occurred. Okay? But if we're talking about an adult dealing with other adults doing adult things, show me the crime. Show me the crime. So, he goes on to write, Polinsky used what he calls a standard model of how punishment deters crime. This model harkens back to Gary Becker, the Nobel Prize winning University of Chicago theorist who gained fame for applying econ theory to many non-traditional walks of life. Becker's model assumes that criminals are rational, forward-looking individuals who coolly decide whether to commit a crime by carefully weighing the gains from the misdeed, the probability of getting caught, and the unpleasantness of punishment. These imaginary criminals are as rational as any business manager deciding whether to drill a new oil well. Becker theory yields one key result: the notion that it's possible for society to substitute very harsh punishment for very strict enforcement. If criminals are rational and risk averse, a small chance of a very severe punishment is even scarier than a large chance of a small punishment. So society can save money by employing fewer police and catching fewer criminals, but making prison sentences very long and harsh for those who get caught. By now, anyone who has actually worked in law enforcement is probably tearing their hair out as they read this. Real life criminals are nothing like the hyper rational calculating machines in Becker's model. They tend to be impulsive, short term thinkings that they can't really imagine what a 50-year prison sentence would really feel like. They often commit crimes in the heat of the moment and regret them bitterly years later. Now it goes on and on and on and on. Does he ever talk about abolitionism? Let me do some speed reading right quick. It's a couple of more paragraphs here. Now, he really doesn't present abolition of slavery as an option in his article. But I'm still grateful that he used the title that he did. Turning prisoners into slaves doesn't deter crime. And he points out that the U.S. Constitution did not abolish slavery, but it makes slavery legal as a form of punishment. So that is worth something to me. And I was kind of like, I had to do a double look, and when I looked at the name of the publication, I'm like, Michael Bloomberg allowed something like this to go out over his publication, you know, telling people that prisoners are slaves and that the Constitution did not abolish slavery? Yeah, I think that's making headway there. All right. So got one more story before I wrap it up. I might go past, you know, the top of the hour, however much time I need, but I really do want to take a look at this story coming to you from USA Today. Oh, that's not it. Let me pull it up. This white female, she's a teenager. She's in high school, about to go to college, I believe. And in this USA Today article, it says, teen accuses parents of racism, raises $35,000 on GoFundMe for college. This article, written by Jody Callahan of the Memphis Commercial Appeal. So let me share some of this with you. After an EADS, that's the name of the city, I guess, EADS, after an EADS teenager used a crowdfunding site to accuse her parents of racism over her black boyfriend, supporters have contributed nearly $35,000 to pay for her college tuition. Allie Dowdle, 18, who is white and a senior at the Hutchinson School, posted her GoFundMe plea online January the 11th, 10 days ago, and barely a week later, contributors raised $34,675, far surpassing the original goal she set of $10,000. But the crowdfunding site in the teen's tale of woe haven't been without controversy. This began, Dottle wrote, about a year ago when she informed her parents, Bill and Demetra Dowdle, that she was dating Michael Swift. Swift, who is black, is a former soccer standout at Memphis University School, who now plays midfield and forward as a freshman at Clemson University. His father is Michael Swift, who spent 4 years in the NFL with the Carolina Panthers, Jacksonville Jaguars, and San Diego Chargers. I showed my parents his picture, and the conversation was over before it even began, Dottle wrote. My dad did not give me an option. He told me that I was not allowed to see Michael ever again. Why? Strictly because of skin color. It wasn't a quiet no either. I'll never forget the yelling my parents did when they expressed how disappointed they were in me that I could do so much better. So it sounds to me, though, like they are racist. All right. Now, I'll get to the part that I talked about in the beginning where he allegedly says that, oh, I'm worried about the racial climate, and that's why I don't want my daughter dating this black guy. But if they're telling her that she can do so much better, that sounds like racism. Okay. I don't know his father. If he spent 4 years in the NFL, unless he spent his money on a bunch of gold chains and rims and expensive cars and stuff like that, he probably ain't no poor man. He probably ain't no poor man. This kid is in college. All right. He seems to have his stuff together in terms of his academics, and looks like he has a pretty promising future. So, I mean, I wonder what they would say if she brought home some white guy who wasn't even in college but was a factory worker. Would they be telling her, yo, you could do so much better? Go find you a college student or whatever. I don't know. But they sound racist to me if they're saying that she could do so much better. I would agree with her. That is simply because of his skin color. So that is practicing racism. When you mistreat someone based on skin color, or you believe that your skin color makes you superior over other people, that's what racism is. It's that simple. People try to complicate the definition, but it's not complicated at all. It's simply the mistreatment based on somebody's skin color. All right, so Dottle continued to see Swift in secret, but about a month ago, she told her parents they were still dating. According to Dottle, her parents then took away her phone, car, and money, and then refused to pay for college. Dottle added that she was still living at home, though, so they didn't go as far as kicking her out the house and what have you, because they would probably be like, oh, she might go live with the nigger if we kick her out the house. And so they did all of that. And so she said that she then created this GoFundMe to go to college. Messages and phone calls left for the Dottle family were not returned. Reached at his Collierville home earlier this week, the elder Swift also declined to comment. What you calling him for? You know, what? Why? It's not his son. He's not telling his son you can't date her because she's white or whatever. He's not telling. What do you want his comments for? I don't know. However, Bill Dotto spoke to the New York Daily News earlier, this the father, saying that his daughter dating a black man may not be his preference because of issues involved with biracial dating in the South. It was never about race, the paper quoted Dotto was saying, adding that his daughter's comments are a justification and gave her the moral high ground. Dotto said he disapproved of Swift and another of his daughter's boyfriends because she started dating them secretly. Dotto added that he decided to cut off her college money because she has been spoiled and it became obvious that she needed to go out in the world and grow up, the paper said. I find that to be complete BS. Come on now. That's BS. All right. And now, if he'd have just came out with this part right here, if this is all he had said and we didn't hear all this other stuff where he was saying dating a black man may not be his preference because of issues involved with biracial dating in the South. All right. If he had just said that, I would just simply refer to him as a racist suspect or suspected racist, meaning I can't say he's a racist because that's not a racist comment. Because if that's a racist comment, then we have to say a lot of black people are racist too. Because again, I had this conversation with my daughters, okay? Because they played soccer, which a lot of black kids don't play, but they played soccer. They made friends, white friends and whatnot. Sometimes those white friends, mostly females, would come over. So I start questioning, okay, what's going on here? I had a conversation with them about where we live, the type of area we live in, lots of races around here. And I said, I prefer you not date any white boys. Don't be bringing no white boys over here. I don't want that kind of headache because then I might have to hurt somebody and you don't want to see your dad go to jail or prison because he had to murder one of these racist crackers for doing something to you. All right. So I had that conversation with her, with both of them. And that was the end of it. It was never brought up again. Did they continue to have white friends? Yes, they still have white friends. They still sometimes come over to the house, even though my daughters have moved out the house or whatnot. But they, in terms of their dating choices, they have been black men. And one of the guys, I would have never known that he had a white parent until somebody told me, because he light-skinned, he kind of looked like Colin Kaepernick, and he kept his hair cut short and not long, but he ended up being the father of my oldest grandson, okay? But I never knew that he was biracial. But guess what? It wouldn't have been a problem. And I'm just being honest, it wouldn't have been a problem. Now, let me keep it real, though. Since I had that conversation with my daughters back then, I have seen a number of interracial couples in this area, a lot of interracial children, biracial children, and I'm not hearing about anybody attacking them. I mean, like, you know, beating them, attacking them, confronting them on the streets or anything like that. In terms of, I don't know where they live. It doesn't really say the state. What state? Oh, Tennessee. So yeah, they are in the South. So it may be like that. Or it could be he just embarrassed and he don't want to hear his friends laughing at him and talking about his daughter being, you know, sexed up by some nigger and what have you. That's probably what he's more worried about, is any kind of side eyes that he's going to be looked at. How he's going to be looked at, and hey, y'all didn't raise y'all daughter right or something like that. This kind of again speaks to a conversation that came up last week on last week's program and on a different program about whether or not black males should target white females in terms of sexual relationships and producing children. I gave my thoughts on that. This is kind of related. What it is that these white parents don't want a black grandchild. That's what it is. It's fear of a black planet. It's fear of white genetic annihilation. That's what it is. All right. Because the African gene is dominant. And the African gene is going to show up in that child. And then if that child marries another African descendant person, then that whatever European gene, I don't know what tribe they belong to or what nationality or whatnot, but it's going to be diminished. And so this is a fear that a lot of white people have that they don't want to talk about openly, is their declining population numbers. Again, their fault, nobody else's fault. They the ones that want to wage war on the whole world, and they don't mind going off to die for these rich people, and they getting killed, or they coming back maimed and unable to make a suitable mate to anyone. Okay. And so then as they see more and more of their daughters dating black men and what have you, they are concerned. They also know white women aren't having as many children as they used to. So this is, again, this is a fear. They're expressing a fear of white genetic annihilation. They are expressing fear of a black planet. Okay? So, now, in terms of whether or not I would donate any money to this girl, no, I would not. I would not, because guess what? I got my own children to take care of, even though they grown and they adults. My mom never stopped helping me when I needed help. I'll never stop helping them. And what? I don't have money to be giving to other people's children to put them through college. You know, I told my daughters, go, and they have, go to community college. We're not going into debt. So you can go to a HBCU and all that, because I really don't see how they can justify the cost. We went and looked at a couple of HBCUs, and no, I'm not going into debt for that. All right. You're not going to be like my sister in your 40s, about to turn 50, and still paying off college loans. No, we're not finna do that. So, yeah. Let me see. That's about it. That's about all I have for you today on this Black Talk Radio News Weekly. I will be back next week with another lineup of stories that have occurred all throughout the week. But you can also catch some of my podcasts. I am starting to produce more podcasts and videos as I have time, and I publish them to blacktalkradionetwork.com or our social media channels. And so, yeah, it's just I need to concentrate more on growing the network and helping independent black radio hosts, those who are doing it now and those who want to become independent black media producers. And I have to say I am seeing some fruits from that labor, as I have been able to connect with new people and point them in the right direction, and they've even used some of our services that we provide for new media through our website, blacktalkmediaproject.org. All right, so I will be back on air next Saturday, but keep it locked right here on Black Talk Radio Network. There's always interesting program, not just on this station, but other stations on the network as well, as we have a number of independent black radio stations on blacktalkradionetwork.com. Recognize the fact that we live behind the enemy lines of USA Inc. You just had this white person writing for Bloomberg, a major financial paper in the United States, tell you that slavery was never abolished, that they turned prisoners into slaves. So that should be a clue right there that slavery was never abolished. If you don't want to believe me as a black man that slavery was never abolished, maybe you'll believe these white people when they tell you. But if you, once you recognize that fact, it'll change your perspective. And then you might see the need to become part of the new abolitionist movement that has sprang up in the last 5 years, where we are focusing on ending slavery once and for all, to include the removal of the exception clause from the 13th Amendment of the United States Constitution. So in the meantime, don't become a slave. Don't make them make a slave out, let them make a slave out of you. Don't do stupid stuff to make it easy for them to frame you on some charges and whatnot. Now, you could just be innocent all day long, riding down the street, just driving while black, minding your own business, driving the speed limit, got your seatbelt on, all your signals and brake lights work and all of that, and they still will find a reason to pull you over, and they might plant some drugs on you or accuse you of a crime you didn't commit and railroad you, and you find yourself in slavery. So I'm not saying that people who find themselves slaves today, I'm not blaming them. I'm just saying there are some things that we need to be more careful about as we move behind these enemy lines and not make it easy for these slave catchers that's out here prowling. So y'all be safe out there and just keep your wits about you. Always be alert, be on battlefield awareness mode at all times. But again, I'm not blaming anybody for becoming a slave, but I'm blaming you if you recognize that slavery was never abolished and you're not doing anything to help us end it. Because one day it might be you, it might be your children. So let's end slavery. With that said, I'm out. Peace and blessings to all. Y'all be safe out there.